had the opportunity to work with a lot of smart people on various projects related to ideas that are captured in the title there. I've got three different subjects in the title, and I'm just going to go through the talk, or going through the talk is sort of introducing each and explaining relations between them. But like Jamie did this morning, I wanted to embrace my roots and organize the talk as a tour through Disneyland. So the first topic was complexity, and that actually, for most of the people in the audience, is probably one of the most, down to earth. And so we'll find complexity in this corner of Disneyland. Over here, you'll just find a few ghosts and pirates. There are no dancing bears or singing cartoon characters. So what is complexity? Well, it's basically what it sounds like. It's how hard is it to do things? And in particular for us, the question will be how hard is it to prepare a particular state? And we're going to use what's known as a quantum circuit model to frame that question. And so in this model, we start with some simple reference state. So if I have a string of spins, they might all be spin down in my reference state. And then I'm supposed to build a unitary or a circuit that takes me from that simple state to whatever state it is that I want to build over here. But the rule is that I'm going to build this circuit out of a certain simple set of gates or universal gates. And we put them together in some way to get the transformation that we want that takes us from psi naught to psi. The other thing is that when we're working with discrete gates like this, sometimes it's hard to get exactly where you want to go, and so we'll have to introduce some tolerance or allow for some error. And then the question of complexity is simply, you know, what is the optimal circuit, or what is the minimum number of gates I need to accomplish this operation, to build this desired target state? In other words, we're finding the shortest circuit between the two. Now, one of the things, this is a new model or a relatively new idea on the HEPTH archive. And so one of the things that may bother you is I said that I had to make implicitly all sorts of choices. I got to choose this simple reference state. I got to choose what gates I'm using here to build my circuit. I got to choose a tolerance here or an allowed error. And am I not going to get different answers if I make different choices? And the answer is yes, of course you are. So this is a very different kind of a quantity, but we can all do different calculations. We'll get different sets of numbers. And then the question, or one of the questions that comes is, are those numbers, are those answers informing us in an interesting way about some physics that we're interested in? So that is my very brief introduction to complexity. The next thing in the title was holography. To find holography, we're going to have to walk across the park over to Toontown. But I can actually breeze through the introduction very easily because of the beautiful introduction that Jamie gave you all. But I did want to warn you that, you know, this is a pretty wild ride, and so you should ease back, make sure that the safety bar is in place, and let's get ready and go then. So when I say holography, what do I mean? I mean I'm talking about the ADS-CFT correspondence. And as Jamie was describing, what we have here is really two different languages that are describing one set of physical phenomena. And really the objective, or much of what we've been doing, is building the dictionary that translates between those two languages. On one side, we have the language of quantum field theory, or a special class of quantum field theories known as conformal field theories. And on the other side, we have the language of gravity. It's gravity with a negative cosmological constant, and so that naturally gives rise to something known as anti-de Sitter space. So here's the ADS, and here's the CFT. One of the remarkable things about the project or the translation, though, is that we go from a theory in D plus one dimensions to a theory in D dimensions. So we lose a dimension in translate, or gain a dimension in translating between the two, and hence the name holography. And so one of the first questions you might ask is, you know, why did the gravity theory need an extra dimension? What's it doing with that extra dimension? And there's the idea that the radius in my ADS space is related to energy scale on the boundary. This is a very special class of conformal field theories. There are no, or quantum field theories, there are no intrinsic scales. And so if I find excitations at some scale, I'll find a similar set of excitations at all other scales. And so what the gravity theory is doing is it's really organizing or doing bookkeeping, keeping track of all of those excitations with the radius. And so if I probe the geometry at very large radius, the idea is I'm probing the conformal field theory at very high energies. If I'm probing the geometry deep in the bulk or at very small radius, I'm probing the conformal field theory at very low energies. Now that's one of the entries, and there are many more. Another beautiful entry that we heard about was holographic entanglement entropy, and this is a beautiful idea by Tadashi and his collaborator Shinsei Ryu, where they related entanglement entropy of degrees of freedom in the boundary theory with geometry in the bulk of the ADS. And this has proven in the past few years to be an extremely fruitful forum of investigation. We've learned new things about quantum field theory. We've learned new things about gravity. And it's really given rise to a program that goes with the slogan that space-time geometry equals entanglement. And what that really means is that we think that entanglement of the microscopic degrees of freedom is really an essential ingredient that gives rise to this emergence of an extra direction in our gravity theory, or the emergence of the space, the radial direction in our gravity theory. However, a couple of years ago, a fellow by the name of Lenny Susskind wrote a paper with the title "Entanglement is Not Enough." Now, Lenny didn't really mean entanglement was a problem. He's really one of the proponents of this slogan, the space-time equals entanglement. What he really meant is entanglement entropy is not enough. Entanglement entropy is one diagnostic that we have that has this gives rise to this beautiful picture. But what he was urging us to do is to think about other diagnostics of entanglement. In particular, he was focused on one particular problem that had to do with black holes. And he was, well, there's a quote here, he was interested in what's happening behind the horizon of a black hole. Now, this really cheap cartoon may come as a shock to you because everybody who goes to the movies knows what a black hole looks like now, thanks to the movie Interstellar. And so what does this cartoon that I'm drawing have to do with black holes? Well, so here's a user's manual. Red lines, those are very dramatic. Those are singularities where the space-time actually breaks down. The vertical lines here and here, those are actually asymptotic boundaries. So I've taken infinity and contracted it in and made it into this little square here. But this is the asymptotic boundary of an ADS, kind of like the boundary of the cylinder I had previously. And there's another one over here. Well, there are all sorts of other details, but that's really all I wanted to say. Here I have two asymptotic boundaries, and so as Jamie was saying, there are really two sets of conformal field theory degrees of freedom, and they're being connected by an Einstein-Rosen bridge, or being connected by the black hole geometry. And so the interpretation in the conformal field theory is that this is roughly, or this is related to what's called the thermofield double state. Again, we've got two sets of degrees of freedom, but they're entangled in some interesting way here. And in particular, that entanglement has to do with a temperature, and we recognize that, or we can recognize that as the Hawking temperature of the black hole. And similarly, the area or the horizon entropy, I can think of as the entanglement entropy between my two sets of degrees of freedom in this particular state here. So that's another ingredient that I'll make reference to. What Lenny was worried about was, or what he argued, is that using the diagnostic of hylographic entanglement entropy, I'd really not able to diagnose or understand what's going on in this region of the space-time in this picture. And so what did he do? Well, with a whole bunch of different collaborators, he actually came up with two new gravitational or geometric diagnostics, which accomplished, or which were successful probes of those interior regions of the black hole. And in particular, on this side, what we have is something that goes by the moniker complexity equals volume, but it's a story that's very much like the holographic entanglement entropy story, except what I'm doing here is I take the full time slice on this side and the full time slice on this side, and there's some CFT state there, but then I find a codimension one surface or a time slice that connects those two Cauchy surfaces in the boundary, and then I'm supposed to maximize the volume over all possible surfaces like that. And I throw in some vectors to turn it into a dimensionless quantity, and that's what we'll call the complexity, and the subscript volume means that I calculated it in this way. On the other side of the picture, I'm doing something a little bit different. What you can think here is that I took that Cauchy surface that cut through the entire bulk, and I look at its domain of dependence in the interior. That defines some chunk of my bulk space-time. And then what I'm supposed to do is I'm supposed to evaluate the gravitational action, the action of the gravity theory, on that chunk of space-time. And well, for reasons that I won't go into, they throw in an extra factor of pi, and that's what they defined as the complexity evaluated with the action. Now, what I've described here is what I'm supposed to do in the gravity theory, but what I haven't described, or what I've said, is that I should think of these as complexity of the state in the CFT. And so why should I believe that? Well, there are, along with these proposals, there was evidence that was provided, or suggestive connections. The simplest one is one that we've heard, I think, in both of the talks this morning, and it relates to Brian's suggestion that I can think of Mira as describing a time slice in my ADS space. Well, this Mira really is a quantum circuit, and so if I think that this is perhaps the most efficient way to prepare this state, then all I have to do is count up the number of gates here, and that's going to tell me about complexity, but counting the number of gates is essentially just evaluating the volume of that time slice in the ADS. And so it seemed then that there was a natural connection then between complexity and volume. Another part of the discussion had to do with arguing that at least in certain time regimes, I would expect that the complexity of the thermofield double as I push upward in time, that should increase linearly with the mass. And explicit calculations in both these situations show you that you get an answer like that. And there's something else known as the switchback effect, which I won't go into, but we have Brian here, and so in the coffee break, you can ask him about it if you're interested. So those are some of the reasons why Lenny and his collaborators thought this might be related to complexity. My perspective was more that, well, I have these cool new gravitational observables, let's play with them, and let's try and understand what the properties and the features are. And one of the features was this calculation right here, that the late time rate of growth of the complexity, so I'm taking the time slices and pushing them up on both sides, that growth was proportional to the mass. So we have two very different ways to evaluate the complexity, so that's like having two different sets of rules. But we're being informed, or we're getting roughly the same answer. Both of them are telling us that the answer is proportional to the mass up to some overall factor. And so that's saying that there are certain questions we can ask, whether the answer is robust or informative, that there's a clear signal of some interesting physics going on. So are there other questions we can ask like that? Well, one that we played with Shira and Hugo, who are in the audience somewhere, was a question of something called complexity of formation. So the black hole was supposed to be dual to the thermofield double, or this entangled state of two copies of the CFT. And you could ask, or in fact, Brian and his friends asked the question, you know, how much extra complexity or how much extra circuit, how much extra effort do I need to build this entangled state, as opposed to just taking the individual CFTs and preparing them in the vacuum, in some unentangled way. And so this is the quantity that we're going after. And in complexity equals action, I'm supposed to evaluate the gravitational action on this blue chunk of space-time. I do the same calculation in the vacuum. There are two of them, so there's a factor of two there, and I take the difference, and I get the complexity, or the complexity of formation. And so there's a lot of calculations you do, and you get an answer that looks like this. There's some numerical factor, and then it's essentially equal to the entanglement entropy that was present in between the two systems in the thermofield double. And then there, if we look at it in detail, there are corrections having to do with the geometry, which the conformal field theories live on. But the key point is that I'm getting this complexity equals formation proportional to the entropy. And although this looks like an intimidating factor here, for large D, you get a very simple expression. And in fact, for all values of D, it's essentially given by just this simple expression to a very good accuracy. So that was complexity equals action. What about complexity equals volume? I can do the similar calculations, and I get a similar answer. Some numerical factor, and then entanglement entropy, and then corrections. In this case, the numerical factor gives me that, and so these, again, aren't quite agreeing. But again, we're asking a question. We're applying our two methods, and what we get is an answer that has the same robust feature that is proportional to the entanglement entropy and the thermofield double up to some numerical factor. And you can even play the game of comparing them. No, I want to finish this slide, and then you can ask. I can compare, you know, what the ratio of the action approach to the volume approach gave you for complexity of formation for this late time rate of growth. And in fact, for large D, they're identical. If you work a little bit harder, there's a small difference. But it's perhaps reinforcing the idea that there's a consistency, that both of these are just different sets of microscopic rules that are giving us information about complexity of these states. Laurent.
I have a question about complexity as an action. Give us a reason why complexity as a volume is natural from the Mera point of view. What is the analogous reasoning for complexity as an action from the tensor?
Well, the last two arguments apply equally well in either case.
I don't think there's a direct picture.
There are various covariants. I mean, one of the things I didn't point out to you is I had to throw in an extra scale here, whereas the action naturally gave me a dimensionless quantity. Since Brian's sitting there, I'll give him 30 seconds. Do you want to say anything? It's your idea.
Well, one thing you could say is it's not clear that the tensor network should live just on space. It might be that you should associate the state with the entire sphere that would patch. And then maybe that suggests that like this region behind the horizon is like little chunks of space-time of size volume times the ADS radius. So it's like little pieces that you might associate with it. So that's maybe one picture.
In this morning's talks, you may have heard that there are these beautiful connections, but it's very much a work in progress to connect a tensor network to a space-time And so maybe there's something more interesting going on.
Can I have another question?
Okay.
So if you study something like the ADS, like the geometry where you form the black hole,
yes.
Can you derive the calculate the formation complexity?
Like, sure.
Does that agree with this difference of the double?
The double of the vacuum.
I mean, you calculate the complexity by subtracting the complexity of the Chernobyl double with the
vacuum. Oh, you're saying make a one-sided black hole and just subtract the vacuum once.
No, you don't subtract because you're forming the black hole. You can directly calculate the complexity.
Well, okay, but that's the wrong question. And if you let me proceed, I'll tell you why it's the wrong question. What these were engineered to do was to describe interesting physics down here in the middle of the space, which is infrared physics. But for a moment, what I want to do, and this was work with Dean and Pratik, is look at the other end of the geometry. Now, what I said is I took this infinite space-time and compressed it down to a finite pick cartoon here, but because this volume goes all the way up to infinity, there's actually a divergence. The volume diverges here and here, and similarly the action diverges if we integrate all the way out to infinity. And that's perhaps natural, because what that's telling us is that there's an awful lot of work, or there's an infinite amount of work I have to do if I want to establish correlations between the degrees of freedom in the boundary theory down to arbitrarily small length scales. Remember, going to large radius was high energy or short wavelengths in the boundary theory. But there's a tried and true way to get around that. If integrating out to infinity hurts, then don't integrate to infinity. Integrate out to some large radius. And there's a standard translation between the radius here in the bulk and a UV cutoff scale. This is a short distance cutoff in the boundary theory. And this L is a nice conversion. It's just the curvature scale of the ADS. And if I do that, you can do impressive calculations and you get formulas that look like this. But what I'll ask you to remember is that essentially the leading term in the answer is some numerical factor. There's a parameter here that characterizes the CFT. And then essentially there's the volume of my time slice divided by this short distance or UV cutoff scale to the appropriate power. And so all of these quantities that we're calculating are actually UV divergent. And so I think the thing you want to do is actually subtract the volume, and then I'll get a finite quantity when I compare, because I expect these divergences are going to be the same before and after the black hole formed. All I changed was stuff down in the infrared. So this was actually complexity equals volume. I can play the same game with complexity equals action, and I get a similar story. However, there's an interesting wrinkle. There are boundary terms that you add to the action, and they give rise to some kind of extra logarithmic factor that has to do with what's going on in the boundary at infinity, and so it has the cutoff in it. And so it looks like it's UV divergent, or potentially UV divergent, but it's annoying for a couple of reasons. One is, this is the answer to a question, or it's supposed to be the answer to a question in the boundary theory, the CFT, but this scale here is the ADS scale, some geometric scale in the bulk, and that doesn't mean anything in the boundary theory. Another annoying thing is that there are actually ambiguities in defining the action, and there are normal vectors that have to be normalized or have to be given a normalization. And so this parameter alpha is just some arbitrary choice that I get to make. It's some positive number that tells me some specifics about the normalization of a null vector on the boundary. Well, the combination of these annoying things you can actually use as a virtue. In particular, if I take this and set it to the ADS scale divided by something, then I'll get rid of the ADS scale. And so now my CFT answer doesn't depend on the bulk geometry. But I still have to decide what this L, this other scale is. There's some new scale that I have to pick. So it could be related to the size of the system, but then I'm getting a complexity that's a super extensive. It could be proportional to the UV cutoff. That's another natural scale. But then the problem is these normals, well, I'm talking about a problem out here, but those normals live all the way down into the middle of the space. And so you end up with contributions to the complexity that are really coming from the infrared or low energies, but somehow they depend on the UV cutoff. And the alternative is, well, I'll just pick whatever my favorite scale is, but then I get a number that depends on some arbitrary new scale. And so when we wrote the paper, this all seemed very perplexing and potentially problematic, and we didn't know how to deal with it. And it's just one of a long list of questions that one builds up if you're playing with this. But what I want to do is I want to focus on the first question here. You know, this is supposed to be a complexity of a state in the boundary theory, but I don't really know what complexity means in quantum field theory. And so what we're going to do is we're going to get off the roller coaster, we're going to set holography behind us, and we're going to move on to quantum field theory. But just to get our orientation or our feet back on the ground, I'll pause there and ask if there are any questions about the holography. No? Okay. Well, quantum field theory is somewhere between holography and complexity, and in fact, we find it here in fantasy land. So we're going to start looking there. And what we really want to do, the question is, what is this? How do I apply this complexity idea or idea of computational complexity in a quantum field theory? Well, we better pick a simple quantum field theory. And so a simple quantum field theory might be a scalar field theory like this. And I'm supposed to warn you that I'm a string theorist, and so D is the space-time dimension. The number of spatial dimensions is D minus 1. Having made that warning, well, this theory has an arbitrary potential there, which looks kind of hard. So I will just think about free scalar field theory. And what's the first thing I'm going to do with a free scalar field theory? Well, I'm going to regulate it. I'm going to put it on a lattice. And the great thing about that is that now I've really turned the problem into a problem of an infinite number of coupled harmonic oscillators, which is much simpler, or sounds much simpler than we started with. But still, there's that infinity. And so I'm going to reduce down to two coupled harmonic oscillators. And we'll talk about complexity on this case. And we'll take a simple ride on one of the easier entertainments at Disneyland. We'll start with the teacups, and then we'll work up to the more exciting rides again. So given two coupled harmonic oscillators, what am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to find the normal modes. Everything decomposes, and now I just have a problem of two simple harmonic oscillators. I can evaluate the ground state, for instance. You know, here's the ground state wave function in terms of the normal modes, or I could write the ground state wave function in terms of my original x1 and x2, and I'd get some Gaussian that looks like that. And I'll pause here to say, well, I was looking for an interesting complexity problem, and so this looks like an interesting target state to try and build. But I'm supposed to build that state from some interesting reference state. What's an interesting reference state? Well, I'll just pick a factorized Gaussian, where each one of the oscillators, or each one of, or my two oscillators are just in separate Gaussians. And so this is, in fact, the same state that we saw a couple of times. In particular, we saw it in the CMIRA review by Giffre. But there's supposed to be a set of rules on how I get from the reference to the target, so I need some set of rules about gates and unitaries that I'm using to get from one to the other. In fact, it's a quantum mechanics problem, so we're not used to thinking about unitaries. Usually we think about just the X's and the P's as our quantum operators. But I'm just going to build unitaries out of those. And so here's an example. This is actually a boring unitary because these P-naught and X-naught, these are just placeholders. These are C numbers. They're not these operators here. The important part is that my unitary has an infinitesimal parameter, this epsilon, and that's there because I want my unitaries, or I want my gates, to make very small changes to the state. So I'm not making big jumps, but rather just small changes, and I'll do it many, many times to get from my reference to my target state. More interesting unitaries are when I start putting operators up here. So this guy, now I've got a momentum, and so what I'm doing with this is I'm shifting xi by some small c number amount. Here I'm shifting the momentum, or I'm multiplying by some plane wave. But it gets more interesting when I put 2 up there. Here I'm shifting xj, but I'm shifting it by one of the other xi's. Here I'm shifting xi by itself, or in other words, I'm rescaling. And so it's really this 2 class of operators that are going to be central in my circuit, and I'm going to call that the entangling operators, and those the scaling operators. And I could keep going and make more complicated unitaries. I could have an xi, xj, a pi, pj, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm going to stop there just because I know that this is enough to do the operation that I'm interested in, and so I'm just going to stick with the teacups and do the simplest thing possible. And so here's an example of how you might get from the reference state to the target state. You know, first what I do is I scale up x1 to get the omega naught to the omega 1. Then I need to introduce some entanglement, and so I operate with this guy to get the beta term. And then I have to fix up the scaling. There's some extra scaling I have to do on x2. You evaluate those coefficients or those exponents, you add them up, and then that's, I'm not going to call it the complexity, but it's the depth of this particular circuit. And it has some form that depends on this epsilon, this small parameter, and it has to do with the various parameters appearing in the reference state and the target state. But what I really wanted to do is I really want to find the optimal circuit. I want to find the best way or the shortest way to get from my reference state to the target state. How do I do that? Well, actually, Lenny's been telling me for 2 years to go read the papers of Mike Nielsen. And there's an interesting approach put forward here. And it really has to do, or it's very closely related to ideas coming from Hamiltonian control theory. The particular problem Mike was interested in is given up there. He's looking at a bunch of spins or qubits, and he wants to build a unitary to get from his simple state to his target state. But the first thing he says is, well, we should think not in terms of working with discrete gates or discrete elements, but rather work with smooth functions. And so I'm, instead of writing the kinds of circuits or, you know, various powers of the q's, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write my circuit in this way, where there's an exponential now, and up in that exponential I have an integral. And so it's really this ds that's replaced the epsilon, and you can think these are the o's, these are the things that I had in my gates up in the exponent. And this y is some function that's turning on and turning off various operators as I move along the path. S runs from 0 to 1. And there's also a path ordering in there, which tells me about how the operators are being applied. But that's just a detail.
You choose the coefficient in O to be some kind of normalized, or?
At this point, I'm not worrying about it. I'm just copying the operators that I had before. Or these were literally the operators that appeared in the queues that I talked about before. The other thing that Mike says is that rather than thinking about the circuit by itself, think of there being a trajectory through circuit space that carries me from where I want to go, or it could be through state space that takes me from my reference state to my final state. So here I'm integrating not from 0 to 1, but to some arbitrary value s between those two. And I start with the identity, and I end with whatever unitary or whatever circuit I need to accomplish this task when I get to s equals 1. And these y's in this picture, you can think of roughly as velocities. You know, this is the sense in which you think of them as velocities. There's a very specific formula where you're manipulating this U of F, taking derivatives with respect to the parameter along the path. So I'm, rather than just having a U, I'm going to have a U of S now, and it's the endpoint that accomplishes or is the final circuit that I want. And then the question is, well, how do I find the optimal path or the optimal functions yi, the optimal trajectory through circuit space? And his suggestion is that, well, it's really I can make an analogy with particle motion. I'm moving through this space of circuits or states, and what I want to do is I want to minimize some action that depends on this velocity. And essentially, this sum is the same as the sum of the alphas, the same as the powers. Remember, this was sort of the switching function that turned on and turned off various gates. And so this is the thing that gives me the depth of any particular circuit. And what I want to do is I want to extremize, or I want to minimize, that particular function. And he goes on to describe how the problem then becomes the problem of finding a geodesic in a Finsler, something known as Finsler geometry. But I don't want to describe Finsler geometry to you, and so I'm going to change the action, or I'm going to change the cost function into one that I'm more familiar with that involves a quadratic. And now what I'm doing is I'm just finding geodesics in a real, well, a standard Riemannian geometry. You know, he calls this a different, he gives it a different name, that cost function. You can also imagine, you know, weighting different directions in your space in different ways. And you'd have a more interesting, well, he talks about introducing penalty factors in your cost function. And so I'll give lip service to that, but I'm not going to show you any of that today. Yeah?
I have a question. Why are you optimizing with unity? I thought you were only interested in the action of this unity on one state. So you don't know what the optimal unity is, no? That you want to have.
No,
you're only interested in how this unity acts on that one product state.
This is the particular problem I'm picking, and I want to find the optimal unitary here. I'm really not sure what the question is. What the proposal is that this is a finding the optimal thing here is equivalent to minimizing this particular cost function, which is a value.
What is the initial state of that cost function?
Right there, or it's u at 0 equals 1. I'm starting with the identity.
The question is that it doesn't enter the definition of the cost function.
Oh, it's a boundary condition.
It was a boundary condition in the problem that I'm chosen. Was that the issue?
No, but there's many utilities that would bring you from the one state to another state.
I mean, you need to
minimize
the cost.
We'll see that in a moment. But you're going to see that there's more than one answer to the problem that I want, and I simply scan over all possible answers, and I can still minimize this particular function. Maybe we talk about it later. So this was the problem we'd set up so far, but I haven't told you how I'm going to decide what these y's are. In particular, Mike was working with matrices, and so this had a fairly simple definition here, whereas what's replacing his generators here are these operators, and so there's some potential confusion there, but I can get around that by simply, instead of thinking of the wave function, think that, well, basically all of the states for this particular problem that I'm going to study are Gaussians, and so I can think of the space of states as the space of quadratic forms, or the space of coefficients appearing up here in the exponential. So in particular, then, I'm going to start with a very simple exponential or a simple quadratic form, and then there's some target that I want to get to. Given that framework, I can translate all this discussion of unitary gates and operators to a matrix language and ask how those matrices or these new matrix generators act on the quadratic forms. And now it's essentially a matrix problem. The only difference is that instead of working with the unitary group of with rank 2 to the n, I'm here in this particular case, I'm working with the general linear transformations. So now we're set to go. I know what my generators are. I know how to evaluate the velocity. The one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to simplify. I'm going to throw away omega naught just to simplify some of the formulas. And so what I have to figure out first is what's the geometry on this space of states or this space of unitaries. And that amounts to a story of choosing interesting coordinates or useful coordinates. And at the end of the day, you go through a long story. Briefly, you see ADS emerging, but then you realize that wasn't the right geometry. In fact, the right geometry is this one that's given by this complicated line element. And there's a bunch of coordinates. One is the y, which is an overall scale. Rho you can think of as a radius. Theta you can think of as an angle. And tau is just some other parameter in this Euclidean space. So that's the space that defines the cost functions, or is going to define the cost functions. And what I want to do is I want to find geodesics that move through this space. This was my target. Remember, I made the original state just the identity. I threw away omega naught. And so this is the action of the circuit. And it's supposed to give me that particular target. Okay, just to simplify the problem, I'm going to remind you what omega 1 and omega 2 are and what beta is. In particular, these two are equal, and that's negative. And so that simplifies the story a little bit. Because the next thing I do is I simply take this, I evaluate that, and then I compare, and I get a story that looks like this. And one of the things that may or may not be what Frank was talking about is what I see is that there's going to be restrictions on the final y, the final rho, and the final combination, theta plus tau. But on the other hand, this particular combination isn't fixed at all. But that's OK. I'm just going to look at all the geodesics. And I have a family of them now. And I'm going to minimize the cost function over that family of geodesics. If you look at it a little bit more carefully, what you find is that these trig functions had better vanish here and be negative 1 here. And so that fixes this to be pi. And so the story looks like this. And so then you go and solve for geodesics. And there's lots of calculations. But instead of a calculation, I'll show you a picture. So this is my space, except that I've suppressed y. Here's the radius and theta in the plane here. And then tau is the vertical direction. I'm supposed to start at the origin. That's where u is the identity. And I'm supposed to find geodesics that carry me out to be somewhere along this spiral that's defined by this particular combination of tau and theta. Now, if this was just flat space, it isn't flat space, but if it was flat space, it's clear what you should do. You should just go from the origin straight over here to the point that's closest to the origin, which turns out to be just following the negative axis here, or theta equals pi, and hitting the helix over there. And it turns out that, in fact, is the minimal geodesic. And it's just a straight line that shoots over like that. These are my parameters, or this is the trajectory. This is now the unitary, or the family of unitaries that carry me along that trajectory. And I can evaluate the complexity. Remember, these were given in terms of the parameters in the target state. And so I can unwrap that in terms of the normal modes of the original problem that I had. And that seems to be the neatest way to present this complexity, and I get a result like that. And so that's a simple warm-up problem, and we're getting our feet wet, we understand. But what this is suggesting is that I should think about the problem in terms of the normal modes. And here there's a long song and dance that you go through, but what you realize, or what Giffre told us, was that that original state that I had, which I said were decoupled Gaussians in position space, are also decoupled Gaussians in the normal mode space. And the final state that I'm looking at are just decoupled Gaussians in the normal mode space. And so the simplest thing to do, what this circuit does, is it just pumps up each of those Gaussians, those individual, those decoupled Gaussians from the reference state to whatever the frequency it's needed for that particular normal mode. And so that's one of the general lessons that we learn here, is that the minimal circuit is just going to live in this normal mode subspace. It's only, in our problem, only going to live in the Y and the rho subspace. If you look at it in a little bit more detail, you can see, or you can remember, that the corresponding generators are actually commuting generators in this matrix language. And what that tells you is that this space is actually flat. And so that there's not, well, there's a lot of interesting geometry here, but the simplest circuits, the optimal circuits, just aren't going to probe that part of the space. Okay, so that was two oscillators. Let's move on to a lattice of oscillators. I'm not going to go to the main event right away. We're going to move from the teacups to a simpler ride. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to just have a bunch, all of my Gaussians, my target Gaussians are going to have whatever the mass is, but I'm not going to have any couplings between them. Just as a warm-up problem, because there's interesting things to learn there. It's particularly simple. I'm going to get an expression like this. For each of the normal modes, I get the same factor. I add them up, put it under the square root, and you get an answer that goes like, well, so this is a n by n by n, however many directions you have, lattice of oscillators. And so that n here appears with that particular power. But the interesting point is that that's actually maybe problematic, in that this is like the volume divided by the cutoff to the appropriate power, but then there's an extra square root, whereas in the holographic story, what we wanted was the volume over the cutoff. So one simple solution that you can take is, well, if you're missing a factor of n to the d minus 1 over 2, just stick that into the cost function, and then we'll get the right answer over here at the end of the day. However, what that's saying is that each gate carries a cost. Instead of 1, it carries a cost that looks like this. And I've added the dot, 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 because you could imagine being more creative and have extra subleading terms that appear there. And so it really seems to become problematic if I want to compare complexities for different cutoffs or different volumes.
So to confirm, the complexity is low compared to the holographic value.
This complexity would be low. Yeah, it's got the leading term. Well, this is a simple toy model, and it's a simpler state, but it's still low, yeah. The other way to fix it is to realize that, well, where did that square root come from? Well, it's really this square root, which was the square root in my cost function. And so perhaps what the lesson is that, you know, the relevant cost functions simply are ones that don't have that square root in it. And so I should, for instance, think about the original cost function that we talked about, or we could talk about other cost functions. You know, this is something that folks would recognize as the action. This is some other version where I have a higher power. And so what I'm going to do in the rest, or in the next step, is I'm going to discard that square root, and I'm going to focus on cost functions that take that form with a single sum, because in that case, I'm always going to get this appropriate power. The other thing to notice, and I'll just say it in passing, is there are logs here. Remember way back when I had this issue where I was wringing my hands about logs appearing in the holographic answer. So now we'll move on to the real story, a lattice of oscillators. That was supposed to be n by n by n. We've got the coupling between the oscillators, and we've got the initial, mass that's associated with each one of them. My cost function that I'm going to use is just, this y to a particular power and then a sum. And what appears here is the cost associated with each normal mode. It turns out the minimal trajectory still only goes through the normal mode subspace. And so the normal modes here are given by this. And then the other frequency appearing there is the frequency associated with my reference state. But if I want to evaluate that, if I want to find the leading terms, I realize that, like in quantum field theory, it's dominated by the UV modes, which here means the modes near n by 2. But to get an answer, I have to choose that omega naught. So what are some choices I can make? I could pick it to be an IR scale, and then you end up with this term, which is like the volume over the cutoff, and then you get that log with your scale and the cutoff appearing in it. And so it looks like the holographic answer when I was doing complexity equals action. I have this leading power, and then I've got this extra log, and then there's subleading stuff. Where to get that single log, I have to choose the alpha up here in my cost function to be just one. The other thing I could do is I could pick this reference frequency to be up in the UV, and in that particular case, I get rid of the logs. And I get the leading term being something like that. And there are subleading terms. But the checklist here looks very much like what we saw before. There's a reference state that introduces a new scale. You could pick that new scale in different ways, and that introduces various properties into the complexity. But if you compare to the discussion that I had for the holographic story, you see that they precisely match. And so these issues where I was wringing my hands in the holographic story are, in fact, just part of the new properties of complexity. Even in this simple model, I see that I recover this same list of behaviors in the two different stories. And so that brings me to the end of the tour of fantasy land and quantum field theory, but I'll pause there and ask if there are any questions. And I'm looking at you, Frank. Are you happy?
Yes.
Okay. Then, given the nature of the workshop, I just wanted to make a few comments about CMIRA. We had a beautiful review by Giffre, and so I don't have to tell you what CMIRA is. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to compare it to the particular circuit that I got in my model of the free scalar field. One thing that we learned in playing with this, complexity games or this Mike Nielsen approach is that, I have some really complicated geometry, but at the end of the day, the optimal circuit or the optimized circuit only goes through what I call the normal mode subspace. It doesn't do other fancy stuff because it's just not needed for the free theory. The CMIRA by design only goes through the normal mode subspace, and so that's an element that these two approaches have in common. Then I want to recall Giffre's pictures. In particular, he plotted something that he insists on calling alpha, and he wouldn't give it a more imaginative name than that. You got a chance now?
Drops function.
No. Okay, the chi function. And it's given, it's the thing that appears in the annihilation operators for the states, various states. And so, for example, a massless field is just proportional to k, and my plot looks like that. In the reference state, this is just a constant, and so I get a horizontal line like that. And the CMIRA builds a state that sort of follows the massless theory for a while, and then it bends over and goes to the reference state. And so these were particularly interesting plots, they give a good perspective or a good way to compare these two different circuits. One comment is that there's a difference in perspective in the two discussions. In my discussion, there was no relation between the reference state or the scale it introduced, this omega naught, and the UV cutoff. And so those are just two different places. The cutoff lives on this plot, our axis. The reference scale lives on that axis. Whereas CMIRA tied them together. And so the lambdas were appearing on both axes here. And I also wanted to comment that, you know, there's a scale, or it lambda is referred to as the cutoff scale, but it's not a cutoff in the sense that I'm using the word here, in that I'm really saying there are no modes. I'm going to throw stuff away at shorter wavelengths, whereas what Gifei was telling us is that in that regime, when I go beyond lambda, I'm simply not introducing any entanglement. And so these degrees of freedom aren't arranged in any interesting way. So that's just a minor difference in perspective. But if I want to compare them, then I should tie the two scales in my discussion to a single scale here. The other interesting thing that Gifei told us is that we could think not just about the initial state, the final state, but all the states in between. And so he had the reference state that on this picture. It's just a horizontal line. There's a target state here. I've added a mask to the problem because Gifei wouldn't send me his talk, so I couldn't copy his pictures. I made my own. And so I want to get from here to here. How does the CMIRA do it? Well, it does a lot of work. Well, it starts here with my reference state. It does a lot of work, or it starts by doing a lot of work in what we'll call the IR. And it goes along, and then eventually we get down to the desired state with the appropriate profile. Now, in my optimized circuit, I can draw the same picture. I rename the parameters. It's just a renaming of the story, but I start at S equals zero, and then my circuit just pushes down everybody in the equal way, and so we get a different picture that looks like this. So this is a very similar story, but you can see the difference between the two circuits with those different plots there. Now, if we ask about complexity, as a general rule, you know, I built this circuit to optimize some cost function, and for, you know, lots of interesting cost functions, just by definition, this wins over this. Here, this is clearly simpler. I don't have to adjust anything. There's no hidden scale that's running across or rescaling of things. I just want to get from here to here, so I push down on everybody at the same time. Now, I did use the word as a general rule, and there is a caveat. It's for most cost functions, but there, of course, there's an exception to the rule. And the exception to the rule is actually the cost function that we started out with, the simplest one possible, where I'm just adding up the coefficients in the exponent. Or alternatively, I can also stick in penalty factors here if I want to say some gates are cost more than others. Doesn't matter. What matters is that there's a single sum and that exponent, or the velocity, appears with a factor of one. And what that gives you is something that's often, well, roughly known as the Manhattan metric or the taxicab distance. And what it's saying is, for example, if I want to get from the Guggenheim here down to my hotel on 72nd Street, well, there are lots of different routes I can take, or the taxi can take, and the cost is going to be the same for any one of them, as long as I'm not taking a route that retraces my steps. Like if I head north instead, I'm just going to have to come south further. And so that's clearly going to cost more. And so that's not what I want to do. As long as I don't do that, all these paths in between cost the same. There's an asterisk on metric because we don't really have a metric. When we go to this, we're talking about this funny thing called Finsler geometry. And in the Finsler geometry, there's even a cost associated with running straight across through all those buildings. And that even costs the same as any one of these square or jagged paths. So with this particular cost function, which seemed to be the one that I was pushing my model towards in order to get the appropriate, or to match it to holography, in fact, in that particular case, my optimized circuit or the CMIRA actually offer or provide, they have the same circuit depth or the same complexity. And in fact, there are many other choices that I could make and get that same answer. My second last answer. Thank you. So I really don't have more to say about that other than, well, okay, now if this is the cost function I want to work with, what it's saying is there are lots of possibilities that really hasn't fixed us to a particular circuit. And that actually, Mike Nielsen took some time to go poo-poo on this particular set of cost functions, particularly because of that reason. But here I see it as an opportunity in that we're allowed to introduce new ideas, new physics into the discussion. You know, we could talk about entanglement evolution or expanding universes, but those might be principles that we want to use or that become important in designing our circuits. There are lots of other questions, but I'll just say, you know, that's the end of the tour. Disneyland is a big place, and there's still lots of other things or other rides to explore. So I thank you for your attention.
So in the connection you were saying to CMIRA, suppose there's one thing I don't quite understand. If I just gave you the disentangler just for some optimized CMIRA, and maybe it's not even quadratic, how would you use that to find the complexity? Ostensibly, that's the only object which you need.
Right, but what CMIRA is it's a circuit.
Yes.
I mean, some folks are playing with these ideas, Michael and friends. Essentially, what you're building is just some kind of circuit. And, it's the exponential. And you're going to write a K there, and it's probably a du, and your u may be a function, or your disentangler may be a function. But what you can do is you can decompose that into a set of operators. And you're probably, or what people usually do is they just work directly in the normal mode basis. And so there's A's, you know, A daggers and A's and whatnot. But then each one of those comes with a coefficient. And so what I'm telling you to do is you're supposed to, you know, the way that we're judging the complexity is I have a set of my favorite operators that I'm using that build individual gates in some sense. And this is the equivalent of my Y or my cost function. And I have to say that Michael and friends are working on exactly that set of ideas right now.
So actually, just to follow up on this, like what you can do in this particular case for grid theory is you can contract the CMIRA in the u direction, and then basically you have a product of exponences for k minus k sectors, and then like in each k minus k sector there is a parameter number of times this particular gates involved, and then actually if you adapt like absolute values of the number of times you invoke it, you reproduce the result that.
So it's identical. It's the story I was telling, and this division into sectors is this story about the normal mode generators commuting and blah 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 blah. So this is an example, but for the typical cost function, it turns out this isn't optimized. But for this special one, I'll just leave it at that. I mean, it's what I said at the end. Sorry, Brian or Frank?
So have you checked in the case of your two oscillators, if you added a Carroll number to Have you checked what the complexity are of the optimal?
No, we haven't. I haven't had a chance to do that yet. Sorry?
Would you get results using perturbation theory?
I'm not exactly sure what the best approach to that problem is. I mean, there's a long list of extensions, and we I haven't had time to explore them yet. But that, I mean, it's a great problem.
Can you just take your two oscillators and you do the time dependence? Like put them in a squeeze state, decouple them, put them in a squeeze state, which gives you the thermal state on one side, and just kind of hold it.
In principle, you can. I think the optimization is still needs work. But again, Mikhail and friend, well, we've been discussing that in the past few days.
So considering the time, actually, I think we have to, and then let's thank you all.